10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We go for main engine start. We have main engine start. And ignition. And liftoff. Liftoff of STS-7 and America's first woman astronaut. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Do you remember hearing that countdown? Well, we'll be talking about Sally Ride and the other first women astronauts today. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Our first guest is Lauren Grush. She's the author of a new book called The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. She's a space reporter for Bloomberg and covers NASA, human spaceflight, and the commercial space industry. Did you ever want to be an astronaut? Who or what inspired you? Well, we'd love to talk to you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Lauren. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. So did you get a chance to listen to that audio from June 18th, 1983 there?
I did, and I've heard it plenty of times.
I'll bet you have. I'm not the first person to think about playing that when they talk to you, I'll bet. How do you feel when you hear that, though?
You know, I have to say, as the author who's heard it a few times, it kind of just, it's pretty standard for me at this point. I feel like it's embedded in my memory. You know, the truth is, I actually was not alive when
right.
Sally took her first flight. So I was coming at it, you know, many years later. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
it was
it's
history, right? History,
yeah,
for
it's
you.
History. It's, mm-hmm. it's one of those phrases that you hear and it just kind of immediately, you know, sparks something in your brain because you've heard it so many times, you know it so well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you kind of alluded to your background a little bit, but you've got an interesting perspective on the space program besides all this work that you do in it. How did you and where did you grow up?
Absolutely. So I grew up outside of Houston in a small town called Friendswood, Texas, right next door to Clear Lake, which is where NASA's Johnson Space Center is located. And both my parents actually met and fell in love at JSC. So I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for NASA. but yes, it was a very fun childhood, very interesting. You know, I grew up surrounded by the space shuttle program, astronauts, all sorts of space-related things. But what I do remind people is that for us in our community, it wasn't very strange to be, you know, to have parents that work for the space program. In fact, most of my friends' parents worked for NASA in some capacity. I always joke there was a time when I grew up and I realized, oh, parents could have jobs other than engineers.
That's amazing. You don't hear that very often, that's for sure. But why aren't you an astronaut?
Well, great question. You know, as I was growing up, I was definitely a very creative kid. I was very involved in theater and creative writing and all sorts of creative aspects of education. And, you know, as a teenager, and since space was pretty ubiquitous in our community, you know, there was a time when I very much didn't want anything to do with space and I didn't think it was very cool at all. So when I came about choosing my profession or what I wanted to do, I picked journalism. I felt like that was a great path to kind of satiate that storytelling part of my personality. But it was when I moved away from this community that I started to get a newfound perspective on my childhood. I would tell people that I grew up outside of NASA, that my parents worked for the space program, and I would see the excitement and the enthusiasm in their eyes when I would tell them that, and they were always eager to learn more. And so that instilled a new perspective in me and made me realize, oh, you know, this childhood, this experience that I had was actually special and something I shouldn't take for granted. And so then when I, you know, started to become a journalist and was picking the stories that I wanted to work on, I found myself gravitating back to space and seeing if, you know, maybe that childhood that I did have kind of would give me a bit of a boost in this world and reporting on space. Turns out it did not, because the space industry of today is very different from the space industry that my parents were in. But it did bring me very full circle, and I'm very happy that it set me on that path.
So when you talk about NASA now, do you have that twinkle of excitement in your eyes?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, as a reporter, you know, it's also my job to take a very critical look on these, on the agency and also the industry. So, you know, I feel like anybody that goes into the space reporting profession obviously has a passion for space, but also to make it better and, mm-hmm. and to, you know, find ways that it can improve. So, you know, when it comes to reporting, you're not always talking about good things. You're talking about, you know, not so good things at the same time. So, yes, it's a duality, but, you know, there is still that underlying mm-hmm. passion there. Absolutely.
And there's the history of doing wonderful things, but then doing so not so wonderful things, but trying to do better. Do you think that that's a continuing philosophy and value system there?
Absolutely. And it's something that we have to think about, you know, as space becomes more commercialized. So more and more there are companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, who are coming on the scene to push the envelope and find new ways to turn space into a business. But, you know, one thing that we have to remind ourselves is this is an industry, just like any other industry, you know, in the world. So it's just like the tech industry. And with that comes its own problems in terms of, you know, labor and how the workforce is treated, you know, things of that nature. So it takes a vigilant eye and that kind of, you know, dogged coverage that any other industry might need.
Mm-hmm. So that being said, why did you think it was time to write about the first 6 female astronauts now?
Absolutely. Well, it was kind of a personal passion project for me. You know, as a woman in the space journalism field, I very much find myself, you know, one of a few women in the room oftentimes. I mean, especially when I first got started, I remember going down to Cape Canaveral in Florida and just kind of wanting to run out of the room screaming because I didn't feel like I belonged. I didn't feel like there was anyone there I could relate to. And so over time, you know, I've definitely met so many amazing women in this field, both in the space industry and in space journalism. There are quite a number of wonderful female space reporters and also great male space reporters as well. But bonding with the women in my field has been such an important thing for me and has been a very, very fulfilling experience. And so I always knew I wanted to write a book, but I knew that I wanted to center women's voices in that book because, you know, there are quite a few books about space that often talk about men, especially men with money. And, you know, those are very exciting books and they're very interesting books, that's for sure. But I just wanted to do something a little different. And so, you know, as I was looking for ideas and over time just noodling on things, you know, I started to think, okay, well, who were the women that came first? You know, who were the first women space journalists? And then, you know, who were the first women in space in general? And, you know, I stumbled upon this group of 6 and, you know, I'll be honest, I was probably like most people in the public. I knew of Sally, but I didn't really know much about the other women, nor did I really know that she came on board with a group of 6 women. And it could have been any one of them that had been the first American woman in space. It, you know, wasn't predestined that she was going to be the first woman. And so that got me thinking, you know, what were their stories like? How was Sally chosen? And so diving into that was a way for me to, you know, fulfill this promise of mine to center women in a story and then also, you know, educate myself and learn more about these fascinating people.
And you must have then been able to relate to a lot of their experiences with the one that you had being in space journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Though the irony is I was reporting on this story, you know, you're looking for, I guess, a quote antagonist sometimes in these tales. And it turns out there were 2. There was culture or, you know, the society mm-hmm. who wasn't quite ready to accept women as professional astronauts. But then the other antagonist was really the media, and which is sad for me as a journalist. You know, I'm constantly apologizing for the media that came before me because the questions that they asked the women and the way that they would frame the stories around the women, that was really what they were up against at the time. You know, NASA had its own issues in terms of people who might not have been on board with them coming onto the program. But, you know, they didn't really say it to the women's faces. It was mostly the press who were very open and blatant with how they felt about women in the space program. And how curious they were at how women and men were going to go to space together.
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting. You kind of roast Johnny Carson a little bit in the book because his jokes were just so misogynistic. And to think about them now, oh my gosh.
You know, and the nice thing is I did get to watch those clips, and eventually people groaned and were booing. So I think by the time those jokes were happening, they weren't considered that funny anymore. But, you know, it still was part of the humor, part of comedian bits at the time. So, it goes to show there was still quite a bit of misogyny that they were up against.
Yes, especially in comedy. I think it was extremely bad there, too. So it makes sense. And it was really nice seeing I lived through that. And I guess I didn't realize it as much at the time because it was so accepted, you know.
Right, right.
So, and I was very, very happy to read this book because I myself had kind of forgotten about, like I said, how it was. And these women, again, I mean, I know Sally Ride. I knew that one of the women was killed in the Challenger explosion, but I didn't know enough. So thank you for bringing this, to the forefront again for us to remember. That's really great. Yeah. So let's talk about what that space program looked like at its beginning. I mean, how were the astronauts at the very beginning selected?
Sure. So the one criteria that effectively barred women from joining the astronaut corps was that, when they were setting the resume and what you needed, you had to have jet piloting experience. And at the time, women were unable to get that experience because they were banned from flying jets for the Air Force. And so it was this awful catch-22 situation that, NASA didn't explicitly say women couldn't apply, but by creating that criteria, that was what prevented them from joining the program. And so, yes, for the first years, for all of the formative years of NASA, through the Apollo program, all of the astronauts were men. But, I detail a pretty famous group of women in the book, often known as the Mercury 13. They have other names, but that's kind of how they've become referred to, a group of women, 13 women, who underwent the same testing that the Mercury 7 went through. And they passed those tests. They're mostly physical exams, things of that nature. And they were pilots at the same time, too. So they didn't have that jet piloting experience, but they were accomplished pilots. Just because piloting, having that piloting experience was something that most people considered astronauts needed to have. And they wanted to keep training for space. And, when NASA and the government found out about their kind of, it wasn't an official program, they pulled the plug. And ultimately, these women, a few of them lobbied Congress to allow them to keep training and to convince them that it was important to send a woman to the moon, just as it was important to beat the Soviet Union to the moon, as they were trying to at the time. But the problem was, it just wasn't considered a priority. And while they gave the women lip service at the time, ultimately they didn't take it seriously, and they kind of just, they had their hearing and then they let it go. And then ultimately, the Soviet Union wound up snatching that role of having the first woman in space because they, they prioritized it over us at the time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that we have a space program and the first woman in space because of the Soviet program. It's kind of true,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I think most people forget that the Soviets were the first ones. Everyone knows Sally Ride, but she does have the title of first American woman.
That's
in space,
right.
Not first woman in space.
We're talking with Lauren Grush. She's the author of the new book, The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. What questions do you have about her book or about the space program? Join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. Now, stay with us, because at 11:45, we're going to be talking about how women can get into the building trades and some of the efforts that are going on with that. But right now, we are talking about those first women in the space program in the U.S., NASA. So, Lauren, let's talk a little bit about what changed then in the 70s and that led to the opening up of the astronaut job to women and people of color, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So the country was changing at the time. It was a radical time of evolution for America. We had the civil rights movement and the feminist movement. So NASA was starting to get external questions about why women and people of color had been excluded in the program up until that point. And then internally as well, you know, I detail a somewhat well-known story about a woman by the name of Ruth Bates Harris, who was hired to look at the state of diversity and inclusion at NASA at the time. She put together a pretty scathing report about the state of women and people of color within NASA, it was unprompted. And, you know, there's a pretty damning line in there about, you know, the number of women who have gone to space have been, you know, two spiders and a monkey or something of that nature. And how if NASA didn't change its current path, you know, a whole generation of women and people of color were going to be denied seeing these, you know, people who looked like them go into space. And she was promptly fired after that report came out. NASA tried to act like it wasn't because of the report. And, you know, maybe it wasn't, but it did draw attention to her report. And so internally and externally, it was just something that NASA could not ignore anymore. And so, you know, when it came time to select astronauts for this new space shuttle program, the astronaut selection committee made bringing in women of people of color top of mind. And it was also helped by the fact that the space shuttle was a very new, versatile vehicle. For one thing, it was bigger, and so it allowed for larger crews. And because they didn't just need pilots anymore, they created a new role called the mission specialist. And that had much more relaxed requirements than the original astronaut selection process. You really just needed a STEM degree, though an advanced degree was preferred. And then you just needed to pass basic physical requirements, and that was ultimately what you needed to have. And so that is what allowed these first six women to come on board, because while some of them had piloting experience, you know, it wasn't extensive piloting experience, and it certainly wasn't jet piloting experience. And so those relaxed requirements ultimately opened the door for them.
So what was the process of that, them actually getting those particular six women? What did they have to do, and how many women applied for that?
Yeah, so roughly 8,000 people applied for that selection process, and over 1,000, I think it was over 1,500 women applied. And the selection committee had to narrow it down to roughly 200 finalists. If you were in that finalist group, you came to NASA for a week-long intensive interview that included physical exams, psychological evaluations, which is probably one of my favorite parts. They had a so-called good cop psychologist and a bad cop psychologist. And, you know, one of them was very nice to you and spoke to you in nice tones and asked you what your relationship was like with your mother. And then the other one would ask you to perform some wild task like counting backwards from 100 by 7. And then when you inevitably messed up, he would yell at you and stare at you. But that was more or less pass-fail. Ultimately, they were there to do an hour and a half long interview with the selection committee. And that was really what determined if they thought these people were ready to be astronauts or had the right temperament to be astronauts. They were looking for team players, people who had interest in a wide array of activities. So because these mission specialist roles were going to be doing a diverse group of things, you know, they would be performing experiments. They're going to be deploying satellites. You know, they wanted to see that people were interested in a variety of activities. So for instance, Sally was an astrophysicist and tennis player. So that ultimately, you know, worked in her favor because it showed she was versatile. And then ultimately, they wanted to make sure that people were patient. You know, being an astronaut, most of your time is spent on the ground. Very little of your time is actually spent in space. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to make sure that, you know, the applicants understood that and were ready to wait possibly years before they'd fly for the first time.
And it was for a number of them. So yeah. let's talk about the six women now. Sally Ride, of course, we've heard about. Judy Resnick, Anna Fisher, Kathy Sullivan, Shannon Lucid, and Rhea, is it Seddon? Is that how it's pronounced?
Ray Seddon, yeah.
Ray Seddon, sorry, Ray. Why these particular six? What are the characteristics that they have that really pop out to you when you looked at their background?
Well, that's what I love about them, is because I could not tell you there was one specific trait that they had other than being determined and being very focused. But the great thing about them is that they all have such varied backgrounds. You know, there were two medical doctors, a chemist, an astrophysicist, an electrical engineer, an oceanographer, and geologist, you know, and it just goes to show, and they all have very different personalities and temperaments. And I love that about them, because I like to use that as an illustration of the fact that there really is no one definite trait that you need to be an astronaut, no one true path to go to space. And the Six is very emblematic of that. You know, they all had very different roads that led them to the space program. Some of them even dreamed of space their old lives, and others didn't even think of that until they saw that NASA was looking for women to join the space program. So I would say they had passion, they had courage, and they were determined. But when it comes to the specifics of their resume, it's all very different. But I think that's fantastic.
And the other people that were selected for that particular group, it was also similar in that they had very diverse backgrounds too, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So while NASA still prioritized looking for pilots, you know, they also picked men for the mission specialist role. And so you had postdocs, you had researchers, you had, you know, astronomers. It really ranged a whole wide variety of professions. And so then there were a lot of people that were skeptical about that. You know, there were some that thought that you really needed that military training, that piloting background in order to really be an astronaut. But I think when this new class of astronauts came on board and showed how determined they were and how they were able to keep up with everybody else, they really showed that, you know, the traits that were needed to be an astronaut aren't necessarily what we thought they had to be.
And they did pretty much win everybody at NASA over as far as their abilities go, right?
Especially some of the older astronauts. Mm-hmm. You know, like I mentioned, there were a few astronauts, especially of the older guard, who weren't necessarily convinced that the job of an astronaut was a woman's job. But, you know, there are a few like Alan Bean who were on record who said he expressed skepticism at first, but then when the women came on the program, he was convinced that the job of an astronaut is just as female as it is male.
And these women faced a lot of different pressures that weren't put on the rest of the people in that group. One of them, like you had mentioned earlier, was some of these crazy questions that the media asked. What was that like for them?
Yeah, I mean, the wild questions started as soon as they came on board. You know, I detail in the book how when they introduced that the first six women were selected, some reporter asked, you know, if Shannon Lucid's three children were factored into her selection at all, not mentioning the fact that, you know, there, many of the men who were selected probably have had children as well. So it was definitely from the beginning that the women were getting gendered questions that their male colleagues weren't getting. And then, you know, as it got closer to the first woman to fly, it only just continued to increase. And then if you look at what Sally had to go through ahead of her flight, the types of questions she were asked were just abysmal. You know, I like to point to the first her press conference that she underwent before she flew. You know, people were asking her if she would have quit the program had she not been the first woman selected, how they were going to handle men and women being in such tight, cramped spaces together. And then, of course, famously, she was asked, you know, whether she would have, what happens in the simulator when something goes wrong, does she weep? So it was just, and there's all sorts of moments like that throughout the book, just women, the women having, trying to do their jobs and trying to explain their jobs, but then having to be asked these ridiculous questions peppered throughout. And so the fact that they were able to balance those things, I think, is really a testament to how perfect they were for the job.
I love that when you put in there that the six of them, pretty much like that first day, they got together in the ladies' room, basically, because that was the only place they could go, and kind of said, okay, what are you going to say, and how are we going to handle this? And I love the fact that they were a team, and we have these terrible stereotypical things that we say, oh, women can't get along because they're going to fight, you know, that type of thing. So that was really neat.
Yeah, what was interesting about them as a group, too, is, yes, they were a team and they could stand united on these issues when they're needed. But at the same time, they also didn't feel this pressure to be best friends. So they were friends and they were trusted colleagues, but at the same time, it's just like you or I, when we're in a professional setting, you know, we're closer with some women than we are others. So for instance, Sally and Judy had a closer bond. Ray and Anna had a closer bond because, you know, they were both mothers. They were both of the same, with children the same age. They were both doctors, you know, very similar traits. So yeah, they were a team, but at the same time, you know, there were interpersonal dynamics and they didn't feel compelled to be kind of like these BFFs, you know, which I think I was under the impression that they were when I started writing this book, you know, thinking that, oh, they had to, you know, stand united against the men folk. And they did. But, you know, it's always nuanced, which it usually is.
Probably considering that once everybody got to know each other, that they just kind of fall into different areas, don't they? And then they were put into missions, right? So they were working with other people mm-hmm. and other men yeah. and that type of thing. It was really interesting to hear about that. I did not know all the details in that situation. But what kind of pressures did the women put themselves under? I mean, some of their days were just crazy busy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to astronaut training, it was pretty rigorous. So one thing is they had to stay current in NASA's fleet of T-38 jets. And while they couldn't fly in the front seat, they were backseaters. So they still did get really valuable flying experience. And but say they had to have a certain number of flight time hours per month. And then they also had, you know, scuba training or underwater training in case to train for spacewalks. They would fly on the so-called vomit comet, which was, you know, the parabolic flight that would allow you to get a taste of weightlessness here on Earth. And then a lot of it was spent in the classroom. You know, the way it was described to me was an overwhelming amount of information because they wanted these astronauts to be able to fix anything if something went wrong in space. You know, you can't just call a handyman. When you're up there, you have to be, you know, the repair person. And so they had to know every component, every subsystem of the shuttle, and it was just an overwhelming amount of information. And then also they were learning various scientific disciplines too, which might have been easy for some of the people who majored in those things, but, you know, it would range from astronomy to geology, things of that nature. So it was a lot of time spent in the classroom, and I think keeping up with that was probably pretty difficult. But probably on top of all of that was that the women knew that they were being watched or that they had a higher standard placed on them than everybody else because, you know, everybody was keeping an eye on them. The media was keeping an eye on them. And so they knew that they had to work even harder and be even better because, you know, if they messed up or if they had some kind of failing, you know, it would be, you know, more about the women messing up rather than them as individuals. And so I think that pressure was in the back of their minds throughout all of their training.
Let's talk about Judy Resnik a little bit. And as I'd mentioned earlier, she was killed in the Challenger explosion. Remind us a little bit about what happened and then talk about Judy and tell us what she was like.
Yes, absolutely. So Judy, I think a lot of people do forget, they know of her from the Challenger accident, but she did fly to space. So she was the second American woman in space on STS-41D. And her flight was very interesting, you know, prior to Challenger because hers had the first pad abort. And it's a very vivid scene in the book because the people who were in it, you know, remember it very well. But she did eventually go to space. She had a great space flight. And then when she came back, you know, unfortunately, her next space flight was on the Challenger. And, you know, I think a lot of people remember it. It disintegrated, you know, roughly not even a minute into the, or roughly a minute into the flight. And what I loved about the story surrounding Challenger, at least in regards to the six, is how instrumental, you know, Sally was in that investigation process because Sally was appointed to the Rogers Commission. And it turns out Sally was, you know, a bit of a whistleblower in figuring out what went wrong. So maybe people remember the O-rings in the solid rocket boosters being the culprit. Well, Sally was one of the people who passed along the information of, you know, when the O-rings get cold, they become more brittle and they lose their flexibility. And so I just thought that was a really poignant moment of showing how, you know, Sally did this amazing thing for her colleague who came in with her during the first selection.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that was going to be my next question on that. And she did send, Sally actually sat on a couple, the two panels from the two shuttle disasters, but it was pretty cloak and dagger there for a little bit, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And Sally, you, like you mentioned, that her experience with Challenger made her this great asset moving forward to help understand tragedies and understand accidents. She became a vital resource for people looking to figure out what went wrong in accidents like this.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did that accident affect the other women? Because it certainly affected the space program as a whole.
Yeah, I think of the Challenger accident as kind of closing a chapter in a way, because, you know, when the shuttle was flying, and I kind of try to illustrate this in the book, you know, things were getting a little fast and loose there up until the moment of Challenger. You know, they were allowing more and more civilians to fly. They were going to allow a journalist to fly on the space shuttle. And, you know, they were accepting more and more risk into the program at the time, which is illustrated by, you know, this deviant behavior of the O-rings that they were allowing leading up to the Challenger accident. And so when Challenger happened, it caused NASA to take a pause and reevaluate all of its safety procedures, all of its protocols. And that took some time, obviously. You know, it was a few years before NASA flew again. And so during that time, you know, it allowed people to, or allowed the six women, or the remaining five women, to reevaluate what they wanted to do. You know, for Sally, that meant moving on from NASA after Challenger. And she spent some time at NASA headquarters, but then once she was done there, you know, she moved on to academia. For Anna, for instance, you know, she decided that she wanted to have another child, and she went on to take, you know, an extended leave of absence. So it really was a time to reevaluate what they wanted to do with their careers. But a few of them, you know, just stuck with it, and they wound up flying, you know, even more. Look at Shannon Lucid. She was the last of the six to fly, but she'd go on to fly more flight time than the rest of them combined, thanks to her extended stay on the Russian Mir space station. So, like I said, I think it was just a new era, and it kind of propelled them into the next phase of their careers.
Mm-hmm. Now, these women achieved a lot of firsts, the first spacewalk by a woman, first, you know, US woman in whatever. There's just a ton of them. Do you think that kind of gets a little overused? I mean, do we have to say the first for everything now?
I love that question because I absolutely agree. Yes. Even today, as we're flying people on commercial space flights, there's always this penchant to be the first of the first of the first. And I think the great thing about the six women is that they came along so that we didn't need to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
The idea was to break that barrier, to break that celestial glass ceiling, as it were, so that it became more normalized that women would just fly and people that came after them would keep flying. So that's my personal opinion. But I also don't want to deny anyone the, you know, the title of being the first to do something. So, you know, that's fine. But in my opinion, I think the reason the six, you know, were here is so that we could pave that way and make it, you know, not make it boring, as it were.
Sometimes you kind of wonder where it was to be the first brunette in space. I mean, it is kind of strange, right? But I mean, it is important in some ways, because then we do see these people making these firsts, and then we do get media coverage, and that's good for all the little astronauts out there.
Yeah.
For instance, there's some more firsts planned for the Artemis mission. I know you're probably covering that. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I love to bring up Artemis because I think it's a great time to be talking about this topic right now because of Artemis. So that's NASA's program to send people back to the moon for the first time since the Apollo program. And the stated goal of Artemis is to send the first woman and the first person of color to the lunar surface. And so I think it's a great time to be looking back on, you know, the women that came before and reminding ourselves that this opportunity was certainly not available. I mean, if you think about it, Sally Ride's first flight, we celebrated the 40th anniversary this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that long ago.
No, it is not.
So the fact that, you know, it's taken this long to get to this point, is pretty wild, but it, you know, at least it's something that NASA is focusing on and trying to correct.
Mm-hmm. Where are they in the timeline for that particular mission?
So right now the goal is to try and land people on the moon by 2025. I would be remiss if I didn't say, if I said I thought that was achievable. I think it's a very ambitious goal, but that is kind of the NASA way to set very aspirational goals in an attempt to, you know, inspire people to meet that. But I think that will happen in 2025? I do not. One thing to keep in mind is, you know, as soon as tomorrow, SpaceX's Starship vehicle, which is going to be the lunar lander for Artemis, is supposed to take its second major test flight. So, you know, it's a very long process to get these vehicles ready. So depending on how that flight goes, you know, maybe we'll have a better understanding if we can meet 2025. But I think it's a little... it's a little too close to say that we were going to meet it.
It's a little ambitious, it sounds like, but that's okay. They've got some a timeline, so that's a good thing.
Exactly.
I was looking at your website, and I saw some of the videos that you did, your video blog, Space Craft. I have to ask you, you got to go in the Vomit Comet. What was that like? What was that like?
Oh, I mean, it was spectacular. I always tell people if they have the opportunity to do so, you know, jump at the chance. It is expensive, but I think it was worth, you know, every penny. And, you know, I did get a little nauseous towards the end there. I didn't throw up, so didn't fulfill the Vomit Comet's namesake. But, I think my body towards the end was saying, okay, I think you're done here. But it is a good, you know, this was just on Earth, but it is a good reminder that space... the space environment is very hostile to the human body. You know, our bodies did not evolve to live in space. And so just, you know, it goes to show that there's all these mitigation measures that you have to do when you go to space. And one of them is nausea, because your neurovestibular system is all out of whack. And, you know, people, when they go to space, they talk about being nauseous and, you know, not understanding which way is up. So, yeah, it's just one of the many things that mm-hmm. you have to deal with when you go to space. And it's a reminder to bring it back full circle to the Six. You know, that was all the things that they were dealing with. Some of them had, you know, space adaptation syndrome when they went to space too, feeling sick. And it's just, you know, but they still had to work at the same time. So imagine feeling nauseous, but having to deploy, you know, multi-million-dollar satellites at the same time.
Exactly. Well, thank you for coming back around to that, Lauren, and thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate the book, and I hope that lots of people get to read it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our talk.
Good. We've been talking with Lauren Grush. She's the author of the new book, The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. And if you want to go see Lauren up in her Vomit Comet, just go to Lauren Grush, GRUSH.com, and you can see the video there. Stay with us. We'll be talking about interest girls in traditionally male-dominated jobs like the building industries. Stay with us.